Greetings and salutations. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski, and we are all about restoration ecology in the Anthropocene. How do we slow down, stop, and turn around the level of habitat degradation associated with species loss, associated with loss of geomorphological assets, namely topsoil and aggregate material in the streams. Yeah. The sixth mass extinction, it's a happening thing, folks. We're looking at it right now. But not giving up hope. There are those of us out there that are intimately acquainted with a lot of the natural processes that are going on. And frankly, the natural world is resilient. And there's a good opportunity for us to align ourselves with life, get in the restoration ecology mode, and do good things. Well, I've had an exciting couple of weeks. On March 2nd, I took off for the East Coast, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland area to attend BeaverCon 2020. It was a great experience. You all, most of you know who regularly listen, that Uncle Watersheds regularly supports the State of the Beaver conferences here on the West Coast. And we have interacted with the Beaver Institute on the East Coast out of Massachusetts. And we decided that on alternate years, we would do a conference here on the West Coast, and we would do a conference on the East Coast. Well, the East Coast, first East Coast conference took place from March 3rd, 4th, and 5th. It was a fantastic, well-attended conference on the East Coast. Now, the reason I'm especially excited about this is because I know that it was a direct result of all the hard work we've done here on the West Coast over the course of the last decade plus. And frankly, the demographic on the East Coast is much higher. Their population rates are huge. And our ultimate vision is for the general populace of the nation to acknowledge the intrinsic value of beaver in our ecosystems. As an ecological engineer, ecosystem engineer, as a keystone species, as a key element in sustaining and building wetlands. Now, on the East Coast and in the United States in general, the vast majority of the endangered and threatened species are associated with wetlands that were once in abundance as a result of beaver. So we're promoting beaver ecology. It was an exceptional experience to be out there on the East Coast to meet all these fine folks that are engaged in this kind of work. And it was interesting in another respect, and that is that a lot of ecosystem companies, restoration companies, attended the conference. But we also had folks from Norway, we had folks from Scotland, England, Bavaria. It was a fantastic display of keen interest from an international level. No one from China was there. Nevertheless, I got to tell you, it was pretty, I don't know, I'm not going to say the word spooky because it wasn't spooky to me, but it was a point of keen interest, let's put it that way, whether or not I should even go to this conference because of the coronavirus thing going on. Nevertheless, I thought about it at length, and I said, you know what? And I was to give the opening presentation at the conference, 45 minutes right out of the chute to set the pulse for the rest of the week. I emailed my colleague that was organizing the event on the East Coast, and I said, hey, what are you thinking here? Are we still on, or should we actually do this, or, you know, or should we just cancel it because of this plague that is raging throughout the planet? And I got an email back saying, well, nobody's canceled yet. And I thought, you know what? Take one for the team. I'm going. My wife didn't want me to go. I went anyway. I just said, you know what? I said, this is really important. And especially that this is the first East Coast, you know, conference of this type. And we plan to have alternate conferences, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. Every other year, we'll have one in one of the regions. And so out I flew, totally paranoid, went to, you know, San Francisco International, and then from there to Baltimore, Washington International, and just said, you know what, heck with it. I'm just going to do this. I'm glad I did. It, to me, was well worth it. I got to meet folks associated with beaver ecology and restoration ecology that I had not previously met. Hit it off great. Made some fantastic networking connections and all that. That being said, I had other commitments beside the conference, so I wasn't going to get home until the 10th of March. So I was going to be out in the wild, as it were, of urban civilization for, you know, 8-9 days, all told. And I thought, man, is this smart? Is it, you know? I was thinking that way all along, especially given the fact, you know, that the Europeans were there. You go to these massive airports. I went to Indianapolis. I went to LAX. I went to Phoenix. You know, I was mingling, folks, with other members of our species of various and sundry ages and such. So I'm back home now and very excited about what I learned and the connections I've made back on the East Coast regarding beaver work and restoration work. Nevertheless, with all due diligence and due respect for all of my colleagues and co-workers and associates of various and sundry kind, I have done a self-imposed quarantine that I am in day two of. I'm gonna just sequester myself for 14 days, as is recommended. I feel great, even though I've been on the road since the 2nd of March, jet lag, all that stuff going on. I just decided, hey, it is what it is. We got to keep living. We got to align ourselves with life and go forward. If in the process, you know, we lose some of our functionality, so be it. So now I'm quarantined, and for the good of the public and the good of our cause, I feel great. I spent the day working outside, messing around with some fire resilience projects that are on the ranch here, and, you know, getting set up for chipping and making raised beds in the garden and all that. So here we are. We're back and functioning, hoping for better or worse that we don't, you know, come down with some nasty form of this plague. I am what is considered a senior, and so particularly vulnerable to this, I guess, according to them. But let me tell you, folks, I eat a lot of granola. And of course, I'm very, very keen on natural medicine. At present, I have some elderberry cider stored in the root cellar. I've got a gallon of black elderberry tincture brewing. I've got some very special black elderberry syrup that's good on, you know, food, and it's whole berry stuff. So, hey, you know, you do what you can do. I want to especially give, express my gratitude to my friends who, upon hearing that I was going to take this journey, equipped me with all types of essential oil, natural, antiviral oils and sprays and all this stuff. And I especially want to thank Alicia from Medicine Flower for doing that. Medicine Flower is in that business of selling essential oils and various and sundry herbal-derived compounds and such for our health and well-being. So I was loaded for bear when I took off, and I did utilize it. What was strange is that I wanted to get a mask. Couldn't get one. I said, okay, the latest and greatest is to keep washing your hands for 20 seconds, and if you can't do that, bring with you some Purell or some hand sanitizer. You know, it's like 70% to 80% alcohol along with some other elements. I like the one that's alcohol and aloe-derived. Couldn't get any of that. It was all sold out already, so wowzer. We worked hard at the conference. I had opportunity to present and also spent a lot of time into the wee hours interacting with professionals, you know, certainly out of my class, a bunch of PhDs and advocates that have dedicated their entire life to this particular type of restoration work. So it was a great experience. I enjoyed it. We're going to talk a little bit about it at the next segments of the show. We'll see you in a little bit. We're going to take a break. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. Contact me at stanley@umpquawatersheds.org. All one word, lower case, no spaces in there. All right, see you in a bit. BeaverCon 2020 conference that I attended last week and some of the cool stuff that's going down. There was a big emphasis, of course, on we had presenters from Canada, which was very cool. Glennis Hood, who as Dr. Hood has been dedicated her entire life to to beaver ecology. She had a lot of great input. Dr. Joe Wheaton, many others. Excellent grade of presenters, well-balanced academics and scientists who have devoted themselves to a lot of research. Now, before I get going further in the show, I want to recommend to you two books. Now, you can get these books. You can download these books online. They're free. I love it. I'm an open source guy, and I am very much into Creative Commons licensing. I think knowledge should be free. And so the first book is called The Beaver Restoration Guidebook. The Beaver Restoration Guidebook. And most excellent book produced by the National Marine, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Great people. I've known them for well over a decade, and they do good work. They do sound science, and they're beaver guys, man. They are totally into it. Chris Jordan, Kent Woodruff, Michael Pollack, these are all people that I, you know, hold in high esteem because I've looked at their work, I've validated their work in my own life experience, and so this is a fantastic book to get, The Beaver Restoration Guidebook. Google it, it'll come right up. Another really, really good book is called The Low-Tech Process-Based Restoration. Low-tech, process-based restoration. The key name on that one is Joe Wheaton. Joe Wheaton, W-H-E-A-T-O-N. That book is free also. One of my intentions for our region here in the Pacific Northwest is to develop and train teams of committed volunteers to go out and help beavers do what they do. Now, what I mean by that is right now, and I don't know, I don't want to sound like a redundancy of the redundancy department guy, but the state of Oregon currently has declared beaver as predators. And they are managed, by and large, lethally. Meaning, landowner calls up, says, hey, my field's flooded, my apple trees are falling down, my pear trees are falling down, what do I do? And ODFW says, kill them. Kill them. We call it the 50-cent solution. Go out there with or 20 cents. I don't know what a 22 costs, but that's what they do. We're trying to turn that around. And one of the ways we plan to do it is by establishing these beaver response task force teams out here on the west side of the Cascades and on the east side too. Two different protocols though, two different environments. But that being said, to train teams of people to respond to calls that are being made regarding the interaction between humans and beavers. There's things we can do. We can protect your trees. We can install flow devices into your situation so that your fields are not being flooded. There are things we can do. We don't need to kill these beavers. But in order to succeed in that kind of work, we're going to require trained people. In Washington State, they're certified, and we may be going that route. We get certified individuals to go out and address the problems of the interface between beaver and landowners. Push comes to shove as a last resort. We would translocate the beaver to habitats that have been designated to be valuable, high potential places for beaver to be translocated to, for the health and well-being of us all. So these two books, the Beaver Restoration Guidebook and the Low-Tech Process-Based Restoration Book, are going to be the two main vehicles upon which we will base our understanding of beaver ecology and how to address the issues of the infrastructure damage that could be done, or the nuisance, quote-unquote, dynamics that are associated with these very intelligent animals. So if you are interested in becoming a beaver response task force person, I heartily recommend that you come to the Umpqua Watersheds Restoration Committee meeting, which is held at McMiniman's in Roseburg on the third Tuesday of every month at 5:30. And we usually are there for about an hour, sometimes more, depending on the topic we're covering. And we'd love to have you come along and, work with us to do this good work. All right? So we have a beaver task force response team that we're trying to build here in the Umpqua Basin and beyond. It would be great. One thing I really, really enjoyed about the conference was the whole low-tech process restoration book. And Joe Wheaton gave a presentation on his book and all the concepts that are in there. Michael Pollack, who was a key player in the Beaver Restoration Guidebook production, gave a presentation there. It was really great. And a lot of fantastic information. Look, there's $1 billion a year being spent to restore aquatic habitats, to build wetlands, to mitigate the loss of wetlands. And we need to be able to do, even with $1 billion being spent across the nation, it is inadequate. There is not enough money to even begin to go around to address the issues that pertain to this aquatic habitat restoration, the retention, natural retention of water in beaver dams, the recharging of aquifers, all the benefits that are associated with this species far exceeds. If you had an army of beaver out there, it would eclipse the amount of work and money being spent by human beings. The beavers would do it, and they would do it perfectly. Their entire being is geared to do this kind of work. So we're looking at the capacity, and of course, I am in no way, shape, or form trying to say that the kind of work that's being done by human beings is unnecessary. No, I beg to differ. The habitat degradation is so intense and so profound in North America alone. And some of this stuff, not even beavers can do. And so, yeah, we need to spend that money, but we also need to be looking at this low-tech, process-based restoration idea. Now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about the fact that given geologic time, nature will come into balance. If we just left stuff alone, if we, if the COVID 19 takes out the entire human race, the natural world will recover. We've been hit with asteroids, ice ages, and all types of things. But those processes are slow. And the recovery from intense extinction and events in the natural world is very slow. Human beings, on the other hand, over the course of, let us say, the period of time between the Industrial Revolution and the present, we have managed to degrade habitat so extensively that we are now precipitating the sixth mass extinction. Species are disappearing all over the place. They're going extinct. They're being listed as endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act. This is real. I live it every day, folks. I live it. I'm at some point during the day, I am addressing those issues. And here we are. We're spending all this money. We have the opportunity to use low-tech, relatively inexpensive methods to induce two things. One, recovery of ecosystems, and two, the very structures that we're talking about in terms of recovery are the kind of thing that attract beaver if they're done right. But more than that, it's not just about, you know, putting beavers on a landscape. When we talk about low-tech, process-based restoration, we're talking about a system that facilitates what the natural world does best in terms of its own processes of recovery. I love it. I love it. Man, I can't, I have to tell you, I'm just reading the book and the concepts that are encased in this dialogue that is presented by the book is exciting to me. And the main reason for that is that it is based on aligning our actions, our interactions with the natural world, with processes, not just like putting a structure in stream, but being sensitive to how the natural world heals and working with the natural world on a process level, on a big scale, on the scale of a watershed level scale. And that kind of holistic thinking is just fantastic, and it's just what we need. Let's take another break. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. We'll see you in a little bit.
The River.
99.7 KQUA is a public service of Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is a nonprofit environmental conservation organization dedicated to the protection and restoration of the Umpqua Watersheds. Their mission is to serve the community through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship. Online at umpquawatersheds.org and Facebook.
Back. We're talking about process process-based restoration work, which includes a healthy interaction with beaver, but also in assisting the system to recover when beaver aren't there. Folks, there were millions and millions of beavers. One, you know, there's a historic, the numbers that are projected or estimated to be in terms of the amount of beavers in North America prior to the massive extinction event that took place of trappers coming in and extirpating this species. For certain, there were tens of millions, but the biggest projected number for North America was 400 million beaver on the landscape, building wetlands, keeping the aquifers full. I went to Indiana, blew me away. Nobody in Indiana drinks the water that comes out of their faucets. The aquifers are depleted and poisoned because of all the because of big ag, because fields and fields and fields of corn and soybeans are out there, and they're spraying the bejeebies out of them. People can't even drink their water. But even with that, the water that's there is, the aquifer is lowering. Beavers do the work of recharging the aquifers, of storing clean, clear, cool water in the landscape. I don't know, you know, how permanent, you know, Monsanto's toxic waste is going to be in the aquifer. But at a minimum, we have to have water in some form. We need it. We desperately need it. And so beaver's introduction is a big deal. Preventing beaver from being lethally managed, quote unquote. What does it mean to be lethally managed? They're killed. They just kill them. Indiscriminately, often enough. And so we try to mimic what beaver do by putting in BDAs and small woody debris structures. Now, what's a BDA? Beaver dam analog. It's a structure that functions in the system like a beaver dam. Basically, and if you get these books, you'll read all about them, what it takes to build them and how to do all that stuff. And it's not that complicated. And it's going to take a little innovation, especially on the west side of the Cascades, because many, many of our streams are scoured down to bedrock. These beaver dam analogs work great on the east side of the Cascades because there's soil depth, the subsoil depth is pretty deep there. And basically what you do is you take a horseshoe-shaped pattern and you place two rows of posts and you pound them into the ground, into the stream bottom, spanning the stream. Two rows. And then in between those rows, you lay willow wattles. And over the course of time, those structures capture soil, they capture aggregate material, it builds up, and the willows take hold, and the next thing you know, you have this beautiful process taking place of recovery. Now, there are stages of recovery. There's stage zero, and depending on which model you're talking about, you go from stage zero to stage eight. And that is the whole process of going to a perfectly healthy, normal system, one that's degraded and down, the stream is down cut and eroded into a ditch, and you bring it back full circle back up to stage zero. And a big part of that is beaver ecology. And if it's not beavers, then it's beaver dam analogs or small woody debris structures that mimic beaver dams. And how to make them is not going to be a discussion of this show. Suffice it to say, clear picture of how to do it and what needs to be done and what materials are needed in both of the books that I recommended to you. I'll mention them again. The Beaver Restoration Guidebook, Low-Tech Process-Based Restoration by Joe Wheaton. Please do get those free publications. You can buy them on Amazon. They're for sale on Amazon, but you can get them for free online in PDF format. You'll see a clear picture of how this is done, why it's done, and what we hope to accomplish by using these tools. Now, of course, you know, one of the dynamics of the whole business of beaver ecology not spontaneously taking place in our ecosystem is related to the fact that our systems are no longer natural. In a healthy stream system, you have, especially on the west side, you have large woody debris, you have open areas where various types, vegetation types, are flourishing, willows, ashes, cottonwoods, all those riparian type species of plants, plant communities, are thriving. We don't have that. You drive around Oregon on the west side, you're going to see blackberries everywhere. You're going to see scotch broom everywhere. And very little of the native plants. That being said, it's fixable. We can fix this. We can set this stuff up so that it does work. The main thing is to become aware of the natural processes that are taking place when, over the course of time, the natural world restores itself, and then cooperate with that. So what do? We put large woody debris in streams. That is very helpful, especially when it is associated with streams that are in urban or what we call WUI areas, wildland urban interface areas. Those types of structures in stream are best designed by professional geologists and hydrologists and fish biologists, and they will create those structures in stream. I want to use the word stable, but I don't know if it's that is the right word to use, in the sense that the natural world is not stable. It's dynamic. Streams are not straight canals. There is sinuosity. There is the back and forth. I mean, if you take a jet trip and you look down at the river systems, they look like snakes. Very rarely do you see a straight line, and if you do, you know it's man-made. You can see it as plain as day. So all those types of processes are going on. Well, we build our houses and we have land in the riparian zone. That's us. We just do it. We love water. We love hearing it and being near it. In spite of the fact that that floodplain that you built your house on is intended to be connected to the stream, and it no longer is, because the stream or the river has become a gully. It's down to bedrock. And what spooks a lot of people is that the hydrological processes cause calving. So you might have a piece of property next to a river or a stream, and all of a sudden you start noticing big segments of your land base being washed into the system. Don't be alarmed. That is natural. Unfortunately, Once we move into those riparian areas and those floodplains, we don't like those natural processes. We want to stop them right now. We just as soon have a concrete-lined canal than a dynamic stream. Nevertheless, we must acknowledge that we are an intrinsic part of this whole planet, and even though we've made mistakes, probably where we build a lot of times, we have enough awareness of natural processes and how to interrelate with natural processes to, quote unquote, stabilize these systems long enough for us to for them to outlive us. So, you know, in a lot of places, they'll riprap stream banks and all this stuff. That is not the way to do this at all. So these two books get into that also. They get into mitigating natural processes when they are jeopardizing infrastructure like our homes. Don't get me wrong, I'm totally empathetic, man. I lived back in the 70s. I lived in Colorado right on Clear Creek. It was therapeutic for me to get up in the morning and look out there and hear that stream bubbling by. Same thing in Montana. We had, you know, glacial pools that were filled with water, you know, all times of the year. And yeah, rivers and streams, Little Bitterroot River right next, right not far from the house. And yeah, we love it. We love it. There's something healing about water, and there's something, we know that there's an association between water and life, and it's meaningful. Nevertheless, we have got to learn to adapt to natural processes, to recognize natural processes, and we can install in-stream structures that are modified in such a way that we get maximum benefit of, say, beaver dams or beaver dam analogs or small debris, low-tech in-stream structures. We benefit from those without precipitating some radical damage to our home or our landscape. So that was a big part of the presentations that were made. It was good. It was most excellent. We get back on the other side of the break, we'll start talking more about our beaver friends and what's known about them and what's going on nationally with beaver ecology. We'll see in a little bit. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. BeaverCon 2020 on the East Coast. Looking over our shoulder at anybody that we heard sneeze or cough. You know, seriously, it was like, okay. So that was always in the back of my mind. I'm a total germaphobe, man. You know, and they recommend you wash your hands. I wash my hands all the time anyway. When I hear this and this challenge of this plague raging across the planet, I had Purell in my pocket and I was scrubbing down, man, every chance I could get. But we got to see some more and very valuable information related to beaver ecology. Some of the dynamics associated with translocating beavers, some of the really profound projects that are going on, especially in the, here in the Pacific Northwest, with regard to restoring beaver to the ecosystem. I'll tell you something that was really cool. And this is kind of a mixed bag, kind of a silver lining associated with fire. But first of all, in systems where beaver are established in the wild, when a fire rages through there, what has, especially like in the Metau National Forest, they've been doing, Kent Woodruff's been doing some amazing work with restoring beaver into the national forest lands, and the Metau went through a raging, furious fire here a couple of years ago, a few years back. And Kent Woodruff has spent the better part of his career up in this national forest, and he was way ahead of the curve. I think for 20 years he was working with beaver ecology, restoring beavers to this remote watersheds and all this, and all of a sudden, poof, here's this massive burnout. Well, when the fire was over and things settled, he walked through the woods and he was just devastated. He didn't know what to expect. Were the beavers all dead? Were, you know, it was nothing but black sticks everywhere. And he made his way into the woods, and lo and behold, there were beavers using burnt wood to build dams. They had made it through the fire, and if the profile of the landscape was right, those areas, those wetlands that were created by the beaver were still green and rich. There's another aspect to this thing, and I want to bring this up, and it's kind of a touchy subject because riparian reserves, especially when it comes to fish recovery and that kind of thing, riparian reserves are really important. I can't underestimate enough the value of shaded riparian areas to keep water cool and abundant. Well, there's another side of this thing. When you have a late cereal forest established through a stream system, they do not make good beaver habitat. They just don't, because the trees are huge and large diameter, and they're not, and mostly like conifers of some kind or another, or of such, and there's very little sunlight going in there. Well, when you have a raging fire go through, all of a sudden those riparian areas are opened up. And when they open up, they begin the early cereal processes. The plant communities start out small, and they become the ideal, if the gradient of the landscape is right, they become the ideal spot for beavers to begin revitalizing a watershed. And so there was documentation. There was actually some videos of the recovery that beaver were stimulating through their work in the stream system. And they were accessing areas of the watersheds that previously were not available because they were overgrown with conifers. Now the conifers were dead. The gradient was low, 2 to 8. Degree gradients in the stream and valley bottom, and they were going to work. They were doing their work, and of course, the veg communities that are associated with streams, etc., like willows, they just went crazy. The willows just went nuts. They just were prospering in all this sunlight and water. And of course, beavers take full advantage of that stuff. And then beavers love aspen also. And various, you know, they have a preferential buffet that they like to access in the wild. And the last thing they like eating is conifers. But they'll knock them down. They'll use whatever needs to be used to store water and develop the ecosystem. So a lot of discussion about that. It gave me hope because, you know, in our region here, we've been hammered with fires. There's a lot of academics that are saying, well, it's natural. It is natural. Lightning is, you know, every year. But the vast majority of the most egregious, and I use the term egregious, fires are man-made. And don't get me wrong, we're part of the natural processes. But when I say man-made, I mean like not wisely implementing fire management to attain geological objectives, ecological objectives. No, I'm talking about people flipping cigarette butts and, you know, lawn mowing dry grass when it's 110 degrees out and a 20-mile-an-hour wind blowing and the blade hits a rock and poof, that kind of stuff. It happens every fire that I won't say that, not every fire, but a lot of the fires that I have had to deal with surrounding my home over the course of the last 40 years, the vast majority of them were man-made. The vast majority of them. Now, true, the Native Americans torched the woods regularly. But you know what? They knew how to do that. And they knew why they did it. And they knew where to do it. When to do it. They weren't just flipping cigarette butts out of the car or leaving campfires smoking. No, they were conscientious. They said, okay, it's getting a little too brushy out here, and we're endangering the tribe and the communities and the clans and the bands. It's time to torch it. We're going to migrate downriver, and as we're leaving, we're just going to light it up. And most of those fires, because they were a product of either natural or man-made induced fires, were generally considered to be mid to low intensity fires. Now, to be sure, there were stand replacing fires back then too, but they were not as large as the ones we're seeing now. So, as soon as those areas clear up and our sunlight is getting in there and seeds that survive the heat begin to sprout, especially along the riparian zone, the beaver are down there doing their thing. And it's necessary to do it because, by and large, when you have these intense fires, it's destabilizing the soil. When it does rain, if the fire's been extremely hot, when it rains, that rain does not soak into the ground. It just rolls over the surface and goes right down into the stream, causing peak flow. Well, beaver, given the opportunity, will have a series of dams in that valley bottom. And they will capture a lot of debris, and they will slow the water down considerably. along with charging the aquifer. And there were other subjects discussed, like water temperature. Do beaver ponds create hot water? There was a big discussion on the value of beaver and native fish. All the good stuff that I've, you know, postulated in the show over the course of these few years that we've been doing this. So, very enjoyable. Again, I want to invite anyone in the Umpqua Basin in particular who is interested in restoring beaver ecology, doing aquatic habitat restoration work in our watershed, please do contact me, stanley@umpquawatersheds.org, or go to the Umpqua Watersheds website and contact me through there. It'd be great to have you on board to go through the journey of us mutually learning how to best do this stuff. And ultimately, our vision is to see it happening from Baja all the way up to Alaska. Let's get some health back into our ecosystems by cooperating with these genius ecosystem engineers, or at a minimum, emulating their behavior. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'll catch you next week.